Thanks for downloading this episode of Historic Racing News. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy by searching for Historic Racing News wherever they get their podcasts.
Welcome to the Historic Racing News Radio Show.
We heard this past weekend of the passing of Vic Elford, Quick Vic, as he was frequently known, and that he was a man who really was a master at everything he did. And Jim, you knew him pretty well.
I was very lucky. I got to meet him in his later years. He was a resident of Florida. He went to Amelia Island a lot. But where I got to know him was on the American Le Mans series. He would show up often as a driver coach. And given my interest in Porsches and his great Porsche history, we kind of gravitated together and spent quite a few great conversations on the road together. And then after the American Le Mans series merged with the Grand Am series, he and I got together. I was doing some things for the Revs Institute, where we were doing oral history on famous Porsche folks. And we called up Quick Vic, and he was more than willing to sit down with us. He gave us more than a couple of hours, and we went through his career from the very beginning. He was the first Paul great all-arounder. He did rallying. He did sports cars. He dabbled in Formula One a bit. He raced for Cooper, McLaren, and BRM in Formula One. Obviously, he was most famous for his Porsche success. Many people give him the credit for, and rightly so, I think, that he put the 911 on the map. Because before, even within the Porsche factory, the 911 wasn't very highly thought of until Vic won the Monte Carlo rally with it in 1968. And he talks about that a bit in our interview with him. But he had a photographic memory for roads. And so things like the Targa Florio, which was a 45-mile lap, and the Nürburgring, which was a 14-mile lap, came easy to him. And yeah, think about that for a minute. And he talked about all that in the interview, and he also gave us some really great behind the scenes stories and some inside scoops. And you know, when you get to be a man of a certain age, you can even dish a little dirt. And he did just enough of that to be tantalizing. And we thought that as a tribute to the great man, one of the greatest all-arounders, we'd put together the highlights of that interview. So here they are.
Full name is Victor Henry Elford, but nobody ever uses the Henry. And the only person who ever used to call me Victor was my mother or my first wife when they were mad at me. So it's normally just Vic Elford. And I was born in London, June 10, 1935. Now I live in South Florida. I've been in America, actually in the United States, since the end of 1984. And now I'm an American citizen too. And I live in a little city called Plantation, which is just inland from Fort Lauderdale. Nicest place I've ever lived.
How did you come to become a factory driver for Porsche?
Hard work. Basically, because when I started, you know, when I was young, I didn't have any money. My parents didn't have any money. But from the time I saw my very first Grand Prix, which is at Silverstone in 1949, I decided I was going to be a racing driver. How, I had no idea. But eventually I started by being co-driver with a friend of mine in an MGTF. When I say co-driver, it was a navigator in little English rallies then. And then I joined another driver, and his ambitions were a little bit more elevated. And we drove first of all in his Borgward, which was actually a very fast car. The only thing, it had terrible brakes, it wouldn't stop, but it was a very good car in its day. And then from there, I eventually got enough money to buy a little Austin A35 and moved to the correct side of the car and actually started driving.
How was that transition?
Well, from there,
did you find that easy to move to the well, correct side of the car?
Yeah, no, that was no problem because I was always convinced I was quicker than they were anyway. And then then I became a co-driver while that was going on with what was then the BMC team, Austin Healey's and mm-hmm. Minis. And after one rally in Greece, Marcus Chambers, who was then the competitions manager at BMC, fired me. And he told me that he was firing me because he didn't want co-drivers who wanted to be drivers, which was quite reasonable. And to give him his, in all honesty, he later told me that one of the reasons he fired me was to make me go out and do something on my own. Because he actually, I had previously agreed to, wanted to, and he agreed that I could buy an 850 Mini, one of the factory cars, which was being laid off, and that I could buy that as a race car. Mm. And so he kept his word very well. He actually got a new race engine prepared and put in the car for me. And that became my first ever race car, for which I paid £300. And coincidentally, this was in 1962, coincidentally, out of the blue, for reasons I had never understood, there was an English driver who lived way out in the West Country in England named Ken Piper. Not David Piper, no relation.
Right.
And he had good relations with DKW in Germany. Mm-hmm. And they sent two cars to England, one for him to do what was then, I guess, the equivalent of the British Autocross Championship. And one, they said, for a rally driver, you choose. And I knew him, but not terribly well, but he decided I would get the rally car. And 2 weeks in the middle of the season and two consecutive weekends, I won national rallies. Two in a row, one weekend after the other. And that was what really got the attention of competition managers. And Graham Robson was the first to react. He was then the boss at Triumph. Mm-hmm. And he gave me a contract for 1963, driving Triumphs. We started in Monte Carlo with the Triumph Vitesse, and it was pretty quick. We only used it for Monte Carlo because other than that, we were driving TR4s. And I was driving TR4s, and I did some pretty good results. I finished third overall, I think, on the Tulip Rally behind two Austin Healeys. And I actually led the Alpine Rally, the Coupe des Alpes, even in front of the Healeys, until I went off the road in the middle of the night. But I was,
co-driver error, obviously.
No, my fault. One thing I never, ever do, ever. And I'm one of the few drivers who could say that. I never, ever blame somebody else. If I make a mistake, I admit it. Mm-hmm. And so that went on for that year. Then at the end of that year, Ford came along and said, actually Ford and Rover. Rover was busy getting into competition, but they really didn't have the cars, and Ford did. And obviously had Ford in a much wider horizon. So I went to Ford in 1964, and I stayed there for 3 years. I won quite a bit, but not as much as I should have done, especially the last year when I won the Rally of the Flowers, which was what later became the Italian National Rally, and then got disqualified because Ford had made a mistake in the homologation papers. Then I won again in Greece and got disqualified, partly not really my fault, but my co-driver's fault, because he sent me up a wrong road, which was forbidden, so I got disqualified there. On the Coupe des Alpes, which I'd already won once, I was way out in front, leading everything, not only the touring cars, but the GT cars as well, driving a Lotus Cortina. I was leading overall in front of, says, not just the touring cars, but Maseratis and Ferraris and Porsches and Alpine Renault Alpines. And on the very, very last special stage, which was not even competitive, it was just up one side of a mountain, down the other side, we didn't even bother having service at the end.
It was so easy. Yeah.
And on the way up, the car just stopped. Eventually, one of the tail enders stopped and towed me to the top. And for me, it was over, finished. And we were only 20 miles from the finish of the rally in Cannes. And what had happened was the heel, you know, the heel on the little distributor rotor had broken off.
Yes, I do.
Guess who makes those things? Lucas. On the Monte Carlo rally that same year, earlier on, way at the beginning of the year, I was having a great battle with Timo Mäkinen. He was in a Mini Cooper, of course, and I was in the Lotus Cortina. And we were really having a wonderful fight out in front. And on the very last special stage before going into Monte Carlo, I was on the way up, it's called 11th, a little hill climb, not that long, but important for the rally. And on the way up there, the car just stopped. And again, we had no idea why. We opened up the hood, looked around inside, and then I had a thought, maybe the fuel pump. So I got underneath and whacked the fuel pump with a hammer, and off it went again. A Lucas fuel pump. So by the end of the Alpine rally, in Cannes, I'd had enough. I was going to go somewhere else. So I talked very briefly with Hüschke von Hanstein, who was at Porsche, and I talked very briefly with Jacques Ferry, who was then the competition manager at Renault Alpine. Mm-hmm. And I could already speak pretty good French, so I was happy about the idea of going to France, you know, to them if necessary. But then I started thinking about it. If I go to Alpine, I'm going to be one Brit in amongst half a dozen Frenchmen, which is probably not going to be a good idea.
Right.
So I talked to Ron Hanstein. I said, you know, I've seen the 911 because it had started to appear in the hands of a young German driver named Günter Klass, spelt with a K, who was killed just a year later, actually, on a little hill climb in Germany. But he had virtually no support from the factory, and nobody else was doing anything.
Right.
But he was doing quite well, and there was just something about the 911.
Yeah.
I just felt that it was going to be good.
What year was this?
66.
66, okay.
And so I asked Hüschke to let me drive one. He said, from that moment, he called me my boy, or it was always from then on, Vicky or my boy. Not Vic, it was Vicky or my boy, or both together. And he said, you know, Vicky, my boy, we don't have a competition, a rally department. We don't have a budget. We don't have any intention to go rallying. Yeah, Piëch doesn't like rallying. Piëch thought that rallying was a poor man's sport, literally. And he was only interested in circuit racing. At that time, with the 550s and things of that caliber, and then the 356s, because even when the 356s had won rallies, what comes to mind especially is Liège-Rome-Liège. But that was something a little bit different. It wasn't real rallying in the sense of Monte Carlo was. In fact, it was basically road racing, the Liège-Rome-Liège. And we'll come on to that a bit further later on. But Piëch said, well, you know, we're not really interested in, and Piëch doesn't really want to go rallying. I said, well, lend me one. Lend me a car for Corsica. Because I'd already been to Corsica once just to have a look. And I knew it was my sort of rally where great pace notes would be very important. And I had the best pace notes in the world at that time, easily. So Hüschke went back to Stuttgart and called me a couple of weeks later and he said, okay, we'll lend you a car for Corsica, Tour de Corse. But he said, that's all. No money, no expenses, no practice car. You'll have to do it all on your own. We will send you a car, and that's it. So I went off to Corsica at my own expense and rented a car. We did a terrific reconnaissance with terrific pace notes covering the whole thing. And I went to Porsche, what was then AFN, It wasn't Porsche cars. It was actually the Aldington family owned the AFN, which had been Fraser Nash originally, who were the importers. I went to them and asked if they had to lend me a road car for a couple of weeks to get used to the feel of it. And they hadn't got a clue who I was. And they called Hushka to make sure this was all above board and then lent me a road car. Not that it did much use, you know, trotting around London in a 911. But at least I started to get a little bit of a feel for the car. So when we got to Corsica, I did tremendous reconnaissance. I had great pace notes. And I decided that there was no point in trying to win up against my French buddies in the Alpines and Renault 8 Gordinis, but I would just learn to drive. So I spent the entire rally starting to learn to drive a 911. And it obviously worked because we finished third overall. Mm-hmm. My best friend amongst the Frenchmen was Jean-François Pio, and he won in an R8 Gordini, and then was an Alpine, I can't remember who was driving that, and then us. And but prior to that, when you know it started in Bastia that year, and I'd done my reconnaissance, and then Hushka von Hanstein arrived, and then a van, you know, just a little like a full transit van with a open trailer and a 911 on the trailer, arrived on the quayside at Bastia, and I went to have a look, and the mechanics got the car off, and then I looked in the van, and all there was in the van were a few spare wheels and tyres and a jack and some tools. So I said to Van Hanstein, well, you know, where are the spares? You have another van coming with the spares? And they said, no, this is it. And I said, but, you know, what about spares when something breaks? And Von Hanstein looked me straight in the eye and said, Vicky, my boy, Porsches don't break. And after the previous year with Ford, that took some believing. Whoops. But in fact, he was right. And no production-based 911 I ever drove ever broke. Unbelievable. So I say we spent the entire rally learning to drive it. And I was still learning by the end of it. And then when they went back to Stuttgart, suddenly there was a lot of excitement because somebody had shown what a 911 could do. And the next question was, okay, Vic, what are we going to do now? And Hushka said, I still can't offer you a yearly contract, but are you prepared to take the risk? You really think we're going to win? And I said, absolutely. So the first thing was Monte Carlo Rally. And I led the whole way, except for the very last special stage. For years, the Monte Carlo Rally had existed with all sorts of strange regulations, generally designed to favour the French.
Imagine that.
You know, we imagine that. One year way back, I can't remember, about 1962, the regulations were so screwed that there was only one car that could possibly win. And that was the DB Panhard, which was a little, you look it up, I can't know much about it. I mean, it was a great looking little car. It was actually quite quick. But I mean, it was the only car that could win the Monte Carlo Rally. So there were probably about 20 or 25 entered. You know, I mean, all the drivers who could afford it went out and bought a Panhard because there was no point in going with anything else. But in 1967, we did, again, great reconnaissance, great notes. And I led the whole way until we got to, it was the last year of strange regulations. We were allowed, you know, the rally was split into three bits, if you like. From the starting point, which was all over Europe, to the centre point, which was, I can't remember, but I guess it was probably Chambéry or somewhere like that. In fact, I'm almost sure it was it would have been Grenoble. It would have been Grenoble.
Okay.
And then the first special stage was over the Chartreuse mountains to Chambéry. But from wherever starting point you chose, and I was in Warsaw. I'd been to Warsaw already twice, maybe three times. It was a perfect place to start Monte Carlo because for the first 2.5 days, everybody spent literally two and a half days trudging around Europe, getting to, in this case, Chambéry.
Okay.
And there was even a starting point at Monte Carlo which I did once. Right. And it meant 2.5 days trudging around Europe with traffic, no decent meals because there was always a queue, speed limits and all that crap. But starting in Warsaw, we had a day and a half, almost 2 days, of bliss. Wonderful, wide roads, no traffic, of course, because they didn't have any. No cops to speak of. And anyway, I mean, they couldn't enforce speed limits because they had no way of judging it anyway. Black market money, which a lot of people probably don't know about, but behind the Iron Curtain in those days, going in behind the Iron Curtain, anybody from outside, most of the stuff was paid for in advance, and then you had coupons.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, if you thought you were going to be using gasoline, you paid for it up front, and you had coupons. Hotel bills were paid, and you had coupons. Everything, except, of course, the luxuries in life, like eating. And then, and plus the other fact that most people didn't realize this either. Behind the Iron Curtain, whether it's Russia or Poland or Czechoslovakia or anywhere else, the locals could actually buy Western goods legally.
Okay.
But in order to do so, they had to pay for them in Western currency.
Ah.
Deutschmark, British pounds, French francs, dollars, whatever, you name it. And it was perfectly legal for them to have it, have that money. But in order to get it, it got a little bit complicated because the figures I do remember, in Poland, for example, the national currency was a zloty, and it was spelt with a Z. A zloty, 30 zlotys to a dollar was what we got officially going into the country. And we had to declare whatever money we got and then account for it coming out. Yeah. And there was less control with the rally, but there was still quite a lot of control, actually. Mm-hmm. So we got 30 zlotys to a dollar. If a Pole wanted to buy dollars, they cost him 90 zlotys to a dollar.
Ah, okay.
So obviously there was a space in the middle where everybody could profit except the government. And so we were, you know, all of us, those who knew about it, we would have our own contacts in the country and we would get 60 zlotys to a dollar. So we were happy and they were happy.
They were happy, yeah.
Anything was, you had to be very, very careful. And I had a friend there who had actually been educated. He was Pole, but he'd been educated in Scotland. And he worked for Polish radio. And he used to come to the hotel, and we'd go up to my room, and we'd turn the radio on full blast. I don't think we had TV in then, but turn the radio on. And then we'd go in the bathroom and turn all the faucets on full blast. And then we'd whisper like this while we were talking about money exchange. And so, of course, you know, we'd finish up with lots of nice money, but we could only spend it on things that were superfluous.
Ah.
Paddy Hopkirk and I discovered we both had a great love of caviar. So we used to sit in the bar in the Bristol Hotel, which was then a beautiful hotel. I guess it probably still is because it now belongs to the Meridian Group, and it's the Meridian in Bristol. We used to sit in the bar and eating caviar out of a bowl with spoons. You know, that's what our black market slotties went on, and a glass of champagne or a glass of ice cold vodka to wash it down. But that year we still had this strange, for the last time, French attempt to benefit anybody except those who could go fast. And we were allowed. That was the first section. The first was from a starting point to Grenoble, and then from Grenoble to Monte Carlo, 36 hours with a number of special stages against the clock. And then the last night, where only the leading 60 cars got to take part, which was basically a road race, 400-mile road race around the mountains above Monte Carlo. For each of those sections, we were allowed four tyres, or four wheels and tyres on the car, and four spares, that's all. But we had to carry the four spares on or in the car.
The car, okay.
So going from Warsaw to Grenoble was no big problem. We simply put them on a roof rack. Then from Grenoble to Chambéry, we had to make the choice what we were carrying, and the four spares had to go in the car. Well, I chose, we were running generally on M&S with studs, you know, M&S, all weather, pretty good in ice and snow, with a reasonable amount of studs on them. But then I knew that the Chartreuse was going to be a real clincher. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the decider, but close to it. It's about 45 kilometers. And it always, almost always, in a bad weather condition, has got a load of ice and snow across the top. And so the only real tires to use then are really good snow tires with loads of studs. And I used to use, for things like that, Hakkapeliittas from Finland.
Yeah.
Which, have you seen, do you know Hakkapeliittas in those days?
Yes.
You know, like fingers.
Yeah.
Literally, like fingers.
Yeah.
And each tire had about 600 fingers.
Really narrow and long. Yeah.
Yeah, they're very narrow and literally like 600 fingers sticking out.
Yeah.
And each finger's got a stud on the end.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could drive on ice and snow almost, not quite, but almost ignoring that it was ice and snow. And so I chose Hakkapeliittas to go over the Chartreuse, which meant I then had four M&S with studs for the rest of the route, which was okay.
Right.
And, of course, it meant in that 45 kilometres, my Hakkapeliittas were destroyed.
Sure.
I still had to carry them, but they were destroyed. Mm-hmm. And so I had to make do with the others getting to Monte Carlo.
Okay.
And then we arrived in Monte Carlo probably around midday on Wednesday. We had to then make the choice of what tyres were we going to use for the Thursday night mountain section.
Okay.
Again, four on the car, four spares. Because all the weather forecasts forever said the weather can only get better. No way is it going to snow. I took four M&S on the car with lightly studded and four spares. And then, of course, the weatherman got it all wrong. And as we got to the, literally, as I took off on the Turini, on the Col di Turini, with having just mounted my second set brand new tyres, it started to snow.
Ooh.
And it just snowed a blizzard over the top. By the time I got to the top, you know, snow was already that deep. And I just got beaten back to third place by Ove Andersen in a Lancia and Rano Elton in a Mini. Because they front-wheel drive cars can make the best out of a bad thing, even with the wrong tyres.
Mm-hmm.
A Porsche is faster
under
any conditions, but only if it's got the right tyres.
Right.
So I finished third. But by then, Stuttgart was persuaded. And I still didn't have a contract. I was still only getting paid by rally. But then I won the Geneva Rally. Then I won the Tulip Rally. Then I won Leon Charbonnier Rally. I led the Alpine Rally, my favourite. And the only failure I ever had with a Porsche, but it wasn't a production Porsche, it was a 911R with a really hot engine in it. And the engine failed because somehow, somewhere at the factory, somebody had forgotten to put a locking clip in. And the drive came off the end of a camshaft. But then I won the European Championship.
Right.
And as we went into the season, Hushka said, you know, have you ever thought about racing? And I said, since I was this big, I've thought about nothing else. So he said, all right, we'll start you racing. So I started off with 910s. I was third at Brands Hatch with Lucien Bianchi. I drove a 906 at Le Mans and finished fifth overall and first in what was then the sports category. Where else did I go? I finished third almost everywhere, all the way through. I finished third on the Targa Florio with a 910 with Jochen Nierpasch. I finished. I didn't go to Sebring. No, I don't think I went to Sebring. I finished third at Nürburgring.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great year of thirds. And then the following year, 68, I won Monte Carlo Rally, because then they got rid of all the, you know, funny crap. It was just who can go fastest. It was pure scratch from start to finish. And so I won that because I was the fastest and so was the car.
Mm-hmm.
And then I concentrated on racing for the rest of that year. You know, a week after Monte Carlo, I won Daytona. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Sebring. I finished second at Sebring. Won the Targa Florio, won the Nürburgring 1,000 kilometers. What else did I win? I guess we should have won Le Mans, really, even though it was the very first 917 that nobody else wanted to drive. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult to drive. But I chose it. I liked it, actually, because it was so fast. Even though it was difficult to drive, it was 25 miles an hour quicker than anything else.
Yeah.
And that was the start, really, of the relationship between Pierc and me. Mm. Because we both had the same sort of philosophy about racing, about especially Le Mans. We both wanted to win Le Mans. The last thing we wanted to do was get involved in racing at Le Mans. You know, people think Le Mans is a race. It is now, but it wasn't back in those days. It was who can go fastest, but it's not racing.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about the 917, that even the very first one, the undrivable one, it was 25 miles an hour quicker than anything else. So, you know, if I wanted to go past, I waited for the straight and it just drove by. And the following year was the same. You know, I was the first one to choose to drive the long tail, the white one that's in Steve McQueen's film.
Right.
John Wire and Golf decided they would like the short tails. And Wire's argument was they're easier to drive, which they were. The drivers know them. My argument was the same as Pierc's. Yeah, but if you drive one of those, you've got to race. If I drive the long tail, which is still 25 miles an hour quicker than the short tail 917s, I don't have to bother about racing. I just wait till it's straight and drive by. And there were three such straights then.
Right.
You know, there was the Mulsanne, and then there was the trip from Mulsanne to Indianapolis, and then there was the trip back.
From Arnage to...
Arnage, back up to... Well, White House had gone, but back up to the Porsche curves.
Mm-hmm.
And even coming past the pits and up to the
under the bridge,
Dunlop Bridge, because it was so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when it finally broke, the first one broke with Sommelin, because Pierc had said openly, it's a training car. Yeah. We know it's going to break. We just want Sommelin to drive it flat out as fast as he can, and we'll see what breaks. But Richard Atwood and I drove ours very, very carefully to make sure it didn't break. And we actually got to 21 hours, and what did break was nothing like they'd expected. It got a crack in the bell housing. Possibly from overheating. I don't think they ever quite knew. And that let the oil into the clutch. And they tried also, you know, pouring Coca-Cola in to the clutch and all the things, but nothing worked. And so we went out after 21 hours, and we were actually leading by 50 miles at that point.
Wow.
Over six laps.
Now, what made that first iteration of the 917 so hard to drive? Because every driver, I mean, there is no one that dissents in that opinion.
Oh, no.
That car was almost impossible to drive.
Yeah, I'm the only one who liked it.
Yeah.
They all say you're lying. I wasn't lying. I really did like it. I hated it too because it was so horrible. But I liked it because it was so bloody fast.
Mm.
And following PX philosophy, I wasn't interested in racing. I just wanted to be able to go faster than everybody else. What made it so difficult was it was all so new. You know, up until that year, none of us, whatever we drove, had ever been over about 200 miles an hour. Nothing, you know, 908s, GT40s, big Lolas and things like that. Can-Am cars even over here weren't even that quick. None of us had ever been over 200 miles an hour. Suddenly, this thing appeared, and it was doing 225. But nobody knew anything about aerodynamics at that speed either.
Ah.
And so on the Mulsanne straight, you know, there were the kink. I mean, there were no Mickey Mouse chicanes then. We would get to the kink. And there was no way you could even think about going through the kink flat out. So we had to lift off because the kink's limit was probably about 200 miles an hour. But you couldn't just lift off, because if you did, the back of the car came up and started doing that and steering the front. Because, you know, nobody knew anything about aerodynamics. And it wasn't until John Horseman started experimenting later on that we discovered the 917 had no downforce at all on the back. And so when you wanted to come off the throttle, you had to come off very, very gently so as you kept the car in its balanced state. And then go back to the brake or the throttle, whichever it was you wanted, but gently to keep the car in that state without upsetting it forward and back. So the kink was ease off and then just gently ease back on again. Same was true at Mulsanne corner and everywhere else, but especially Mulsanne, because that's where we were getting the quickest. You know, I had to come off very easy, gently, go back very gently onto the brakes, and then more and more on them. However, such was PX's ability and the guys working for him, by the following year, 1970, with the first long tail, the first 5-litre long tail, I was going through the kink at night in the rain, flat out, at about 245 miles an hour. So, you know, that was the big problem with the first 917 was simply aerodynamics, which, as I say, John Horseman helped considerably, because he really, I guess, analysed the situation to start with, and then Pierre and co. went to work on it from there.
Did the Wires guys, Horseman and Pierre, did they clash a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 24/7. I mean, they. Wire thought that he was going to be absolutely the factory team. But as people have found to their chagrin, I guess is the word in French, to their cost later on, nobody puts one over Piëch. Well, you know, John Wire thought he was going to be the factory team and that Piëch was just going to shovel everything in his direction, anything new, he'd get it. But as others have found out since, and Wire found at that point, you don't screw around with Piëch. And Piëch was determined, obviously, to keep a hold on everything himself, which was why Porsche Austria was formed, with his mum as the owner. But in fact, you know, it was Piëch's baby. And Wire didn't ask me to drive for him. He didn't even know me, I guess. Whether he would have done, I don't know. But he didn't, because I'd never even met him. But Piëch and I got on very well together, so... So I was the sort of natural to go with Piëch to Porsche Austria. And he and I really hit it off together with our philosophy of doing things. And almost every time there was something new, I got it first, at least to try it. Because we went to Monza and there were two Wire cars and mine. And we all got to try the 5, actually I think it was 4.9 litres then, wasn't it? We all got to try the 4.9 in practice. And then Wire said, well, for the race, we'll stay with the 4.5 litre. We know the engine, you know, we know it's going to break or anything. And Piëch said, are you sure? Because the 5 litre or 4.9 is going to race. And Wire said, no, we're going to stay with the 4.9, which means no 5-litre in the race. So Piëch said, well, look, that 5-litre is going to race. If you don't want it, Alfred gets it. So I got it. And I just drove away. It was absolute bliss. And obviously should have won. I didn't, because coming through the Ascari curve, you know, there were no chicanes then. The Ascari curve is the left-hander behind the pits. As I came through there, the right rear tyre let go. And I just went halfway around and backed into the guardrail. I was very, very lucky, because the guardrail where I hit it was just before a space for emergency vehicles to come out. So where I hit it, it was still at that angle. It was following the edge of the road. Mm. So when I spun and went backwards into it, I went into it at about 30 degree angle. If I'd gone about 20 feet further, I'd have missed that bit. And I'd have got the next bit, which was where it was coming out from, you know, access, and it would have been about a 90 degree angle.
much bigger.
But route. I went in backwards. I suppose I was doing about 200 miles an hour. And once the car went round, there was nothing I could do. I just simply let go of the steering wheel and buried my head in my arms. And there was a big bang, and then there was sort of trundling noises. And then I realized the car was actually trundling along. And what had happened, it went in backwards, bounced across the road and hit the other guardrail. I still had my eyes closed and my arms over my head at that point. And then it was just bump, 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 bubbling along in fifth gear on the grass until I stopped it.
Oh, my heavens.
So that was the first 5 litre or 4.9. And then we went to Le Mans with the long tails. I'm sure they used the 5 litre then, and so did I. Mm-hmm. And I was just a bit quicker than they were with it.
Now, do you think that your time in the rally car and the finesse that it takes to be a good rally driver helped you with the 917?
Oh, absolutely. No question. I didn't originally think of it. A journalist sort of put that point to me one day. And then I started to analyze, and analyzing, absolutely, no question. Because driving a race car on a racetrack, if it's going sideways, you're losing time. It should be driving like it's on rails. Never, never getting sideways. Perhaps a little touch at the exit of a corner. But even then, it's still got to be pointing the way it's going. If you apply that to a rally car, you're not going to go very quickly. Because rallies are generally on poor surfaces. If it's on pure asphalt, for example, as I keep saying, my favorite rally was the Coupe des Alpes, or the Alpine Rally, because that was almost race driving up and down mountains on good asphalt surfaces. Mm-hmm. So there, I would drive like a race driver. But generally speaking, rallies are on poor surfaces, gravel, ice and snow, dirt, dust, rocks, you name it. And if a rally car is pointing the way it's going, there's a good chance it's not actually totally under control because you can't control it with the steering wheel.
That's right.
As such, when you approach a corner, turning the steering wheel and hoping that it's going to turn the car into a corner would be just, completely really ridiculous because it doesn't work. You have to steer the car with its angle of attack wherever you're going and the throttle. And you learn, it takes a bit of time, but you learn how the balance of the car is affected by what you do with the brakes and the throttle and its sideways motion. For example, I learned this already the first time I ever drove a Porsche in Corsica. You know, we're going back a couple of years mm-hmm. now. I'd heard all sorts, and read all sorts of nasty stories about Porsche 911s. If you lift off in a corner, you crash because it spins and so on. In fact, nothing could be further than the truth. But what you have to do is you have to learn to do it with extreme delicatesse. That's a French word. What's the word in English?
Finesse,
okay. Because if you... A 911, for example, I just mentioned people think, well, a 911 is an oversteering pig and you lift off in a corner, it's going to crash. Actually, it's not. A 911 is basically an understeering car, especially the early ones, the short wheelbase that were used for rallying in those days. Because if you wait till you get to a corner and then just turn in, it's going to go straight on, mm-hmm. even on asphalt. Mm-hmm. Because you haven't projected enough weight up front to do it justice. You have to be especially fine with the balance of a 911 to make it work, even on asphalt. If you're coming toward a corner, let's say you're doing 100 miles an hour, you're coming toward about a 60 degree corner, you need to slow down just a touch. If you just touch the brakes and then turn in, nothing much is going to happen. You're going to plow on. So what you have to learn to do, taking that particular corner now, approaching it, say 100 miles an hour on a straight, it's going to be about a 60-degree corner, take, let's say, about 80 miles an hour. What you do before you get to the corner, you start to lift off the throttle, not necessarily to slow down, but to make a little transfer of weight toward the front wheels. So they are now going to react to what you want them to do. And then as you go for the brakes, perhaps, you're going to use the front wheel to start turning a bit. So before you actually get to the corner, you get the car turned to this sort of angle. Mm-hmm. So when you want it, it's going to actually go around the corner. If you wait till you get to the corner before you put that in motion, or you don't even put it in motion because you don't know about it, it's going to do that. Mm. Instead of getting around the corner there, the corner's mm-hmm. going to be 10 feet further mm-hmm. on. So you're going to go off the road
yeah.
or lose time.
Right.
So driving a 911 then was a very, very delicate matter.
It's great, great insight. Let's go back to Piëch. Conventional wisdom for most people, and especially me until I got a little bit deeper into this project, was that he was a kind of a totalitarian taskmaster, difficult to work for. But in talking to people who worked with him at Porsche during the time that we're discussing, nothing could be further from the truth. It seemed to me that everyone felt he was a genius and everybody loved him.
Well, you've actually, without knowing it perhaps, you've hit on the two points that are covered by that, which I'll come to in just a minute.
Yeah.
Absolutely, he was a genius. In my opinion, he was the greatest automobile engineer of all time, including his grandfather, including anybody else who's
yeah.
come since.
Right.
Nobody has come near what the guy has done in terms of automobile engineering. Nobody. And you said you'd heard stories about people working for him and it was a taskmaster and all that sort of thing. And then you've had people like Metzger and Falk and me, you're going to have, working with him was absolutely marvellous. I've used the same two words that you did. You notice the difference? I personally could not have wished to work with a better guy than Piëch. And all those are the same. You know, Schaefer and Metzger and everybody, we would all say the same thing. I would, however, say one thing. I would definitely not have wanted to work for him. You used the same two words.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he was the boss, but the racing and racing and development and that sort of thing, R&D and racing, was, I wouldn't have said a family, but, a homogenous group.
Mm.
And we all had one single thought in mind, and that was to win. We could have our own ideas and we could talk about it and we could argue about it. We could argue about it with him.
Mm.
No problem. As long as our ultimate motive was, all to get to the same point at the same time. When, however, talking about somebody who just happens to be the floor sweeper at Audi when he was the boss, I'm sure the floor sweeper probably would rather have been sweeping floors at Ford than at Audi, where Piëch was the boss.
Yeah. So you talked about the Alpine Rally being one of your favorites. You're quite famous for success at Le Mans, and that, you said at one point, was your ultimate dream. What was the mystique of Le Mans? Why was Le Mans so important to you?
Oh, not because I particularly like Le Mans. It's just that I remembered, back when I was a kid, not seeing, because we didn't see in those days. There was no TV, but listening to the radio with the Jaguars and Aston Martins and Brit drivers up at the front, and then, of course, seeing it later on, I just thought it was one of those. It was a race it's just particularly, specifically wanted to win. It was just the star race, if you like, or a star race.
Now, another event that has always fascinated me, and I wish I'd been born early enough to go to it, was the Targa Florio. What was that like?
Marvelous. First time I went was with Nirpash in a 910. And it's 45 miles around. And the road, most of the way, is about the equivalent of 1.5 lanes on an American rural road. So quite narrow. And coming from rallying, it seemed logical for me because, you know, I talked earlier about the Chartreuse, amongst other things. The Chartreuse in both directions was a special stage we used to use on a number of rallies. You'd use it on Monte Carlo, on the Tulip, maybe on Leon Chaubernier. And I discovered fairly early on, although I had a great co-driver, I didn't particularly like him. Don't put this in. And we didn't get on that well together, but I put up with him because he was the best. Gerard Larousse and some of my French buddies put up with the French equivalent for the same reason. His name was Jean Todt. Who was the best in France?
Yes, he was.
And David Stone was, I think, the best altogether. And with David, we developed pace notes. You know, we started very, very early on, 1960. When did we first have pace notes? 1962. And they were very basic. It was like 400 yards as a house left, 600 yards a tree right, and in between, God knows what. And we developed the pace notes, so we got to the point where ultimately I had, without doubt, the best pace notes in the world. Nobody could match my pace notes or my ability to drive on them, as we showed once, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But I learned doing that and working with the pace notes, I also discovered that I have an almost photographic memory for roads. And I could learn long, long stretches of road totally. I could sort of see it. And so when I first went to the Targa Florio, 45 miles, and I probably drove around it the first time, difficult to tell, but I probably about 20 laps. And I didn't know it totally, but I knew it pretty well, enough to drive a racing car for the first time in my life and finish third. And by the time we went back the following year, obviously I did more.
Which was what year?
68.
68, okay.
And working on my memory from the previous year, probably doing maybe another 20 laps, I don't remember, obviously. By the time I started it in 1968, I knew every inch of it. I knew where I would be braking. I knew my line through corners. I knew my gear change places. I knew that, you know, for example, just one example. There was one corner which led down into a marble quarry. And I would turn in, drive into the corner. I'll come to another thing about racing and rallying in a minute with the same thing. I would turn into the corner and the car would just take off and skate across the road. And I knew it was no problem. I could let it go because about 1 meter before it got to the wall at the edge of the road, it would stop and pick up grip again because there was no dust there. And I learned just totally, absolutely totally. I could never, well, that year in 68 when I did lap record after lap record, I could not have driven any quicker on any single corner. And one of the things I discovered also in Targa Florio was, you know, I talked earlier about driving a race car like it's on rails. If it's going sideways, it's losing time, except on the Targa Florio, because there are three little towns, cities, whatever you call them, Cerda, Galesano and Campo Felice. And outside of those towns, the road is good, firm, grippy asphalt. In the towns, it's covered with this, with marble dust, which is so fine you almost don't even see it.
Right.
And it's as slippery as ice. So if you come into one of the villages and you try and steer around a corner, you're going to go straight on. So I was able to adapt. I would drive like a race driver out in the mountains. As soon as I came to one of the towns, I would start driving like a rally driver sideways, all the way through the village or town. And then as I got out the other side, back to being a race driver again, and drive on rails, which obviously made a big difference.
Yeah.
And I was the only one who could do it. Six times, yeah. I was the fastest driver there. And various things happened. In 68, I won.
Right.
In 69, I was leading already. Early on in the race, when about halfway through the lap, my alternator belt broke. And so I was running on the battery, and it just went down and down and down. And, you know, in 68, when I won, I started the second lap 18 minutes behind the leading car. I won. In 69, I started the second lap about 4 minutes behind the leading car. Unfortunately, that was Mitter in a Porsche, who wasn't as quick as me, but he was quick enough to stay in front.
Yeah.
So I finished second.
What all did you drive Porsche at the time? You started with, what, the 906?
No, 910.
910.
The first year was the 910. Mm-hmm. Paul Hawkins and Leo, I can't remember his name, Chera, won it in a 2.2 litre 907. Then another 907 was second, and Jochen and I were third.
In the 910.
Both of us, our first visit there. Following year, I drove 907, 2.2 litre. And that was the year I had problems on the first lap with a wheel coming off. And actually, after Cheddar, the road turns left to go off into the mountains. I came through the corner, put my foot on the throttle, and it went, boom! I thought, mad. I've broken the gearbox or the clutch or something. So I stopped, got out, and I found that what had happened was that there was actually, we found later, a faulty lug nut. And it had started to undo itself sufficiently that the wheel was coming off the splines. The nut didn't come all the way off, thank goodness, and the wheel was still there, but it wasn't on the splines. And so I went to start getting tools out, and the spectators, you tell me why, I have no idea, a Brit in a German car, but all the spectators came down from where they were sitting on a bank, physically lifted the car up while I tightened the wheel up again and went off. And I got up to about the halfway point up in the mountains where the factory teams and the major private teams would have a sort of unofficial pit area or mechanics and tools. So they changed the wheel, tightened it up again, but it was the same lug nut. And I set off again. I got about 10 kilometers down the road, and the same thing happened. The wheel came off, and I slid off and punctured the front wheel up against the curbstone. Once again, round for the tools, but again the spectators came, and of course we didn't have spare wheels as such, because you couldn't carry one. There wasn't room. What we did carry was a wheel with a Goodyear Space Saver. And so once again, the mechanics came along, lifted the car up while I tightened the rear wheel up, and then changed the front wheel, threw the front wheel away, and put on my Space Saver. And then I just got braver and braver and braver on my Space Saver and made it back to the pits. No problem, believe it or not. And then the mechanics changed all four wheels, changed all four lug nuts, and I started the second lap 18 minutes behind the leader. I thought, well, that's it, I'm not going to win the race, but I'm damn sure going to have the lap record. So I did, pretty well every lap. And originally I was going to drive three laps. Umberto Maglioli was going to drive four in the middle, and then I was going to drive the last three. But with this, of course, I'd done one lap, so I then drove, three to bring it to four, and then Umberto was going to do his four. But when he was about halfway through his third lap, and I was sitting there looking at times with Bott and Falcon, I said, you know, if I go out and do the times I was doing earlier, because I was quite a bit quicker than Umberto, we could still win. And they said, sure, you can do that. I said, yeah, I think so. So much to Umberto's disgust, he came in after three laps, and I went off and did the last three instead of two, and we did win.
And then after that?
Yeah, the following year was the 908.3.
What was that car like?
Following year was the 908.
908.
Open 908.
Okay.
And that was where I had my alternator problem.
Right.
I was fastest in practice and way ahead on the first couple of laps, and the alternator belt broke. And I slowly, it was got slower as it went on around to the pit. So I started the second lap at 4 minutes. I think it was actually about 6 minutes down on Mitter, and I made up about four, but I couldn't catch him.
Yeah.
So I finished second.
Yeah. And in 70, you drove the 908.3.
908.3.
What was that car like?
That was absolute marvelous.
Was it?
Wonderful.
Was it as hard to drive as the 917 or easier?
Well, I...
But, I mean, just as a car, was the 908 easier or harder to drive?
Much easier.
Much easier. Okay. Yeah.
And around the Targa Florio, the 908-3 was like driving a roller skate. You know, it was so tiny. We sat right up between the front wheels, so visibility was fantastic. As usual, I had the fastest time in practice. And in the race, somebody in front of me, or spectators or whatever, had kicked a rock about that size onto the road. I came through a corner, and I didn't want to hit it because we had a ground clearance of about that much. And so I swerved to try and miss it, and I hit the edge of the road and broke the steering arm. So that was the end of the race for me. And then spectators helped me sort of pull the car back up a little track away from the road. And I spent the entire lap being race being wined and dined by a big Italian family. And then when the race was over, they said, "Oh, you can go. We'll drive you to the hotel. Don't leave the car with us." I don't think so. So I waited until eventually a couple of cars arrived with mechanics, and one of them gave me a lift back. Oh, they undid the broken bit and then put a new bit on so one could drive the race car and a mechanics car in front. And the other car took me back to the hotel. And we got back to the hotel. We used to stay in the Hotel Santa Lucia. And we used to have a long table, probably almost as long as from where I'm sitting to that wall in the restaurant, with all the team in there. And I come in, they just finished dinner. So I walked the whole length of the table right to the far end. There's PIEC at the end of the table. And I put the two pieces of the steering rod on the table. And he just looked at me and said, "Is that all that's broken or all that's left?" Coming on to the last 908 was 908-3 in 1971. Mm-hmm. There, PIEC decided he was going to stir things up a bit, because up until then, for almost a couple of years now, almost every race had started off with Pedro, Joe and me mm-hmm. having a Grand Prix at the front for an hour and swapping paint between us, three of us. And so in 1971, I'm not sure if the Targa was the first place it happened, but PIEC decided co-drivers would start the race. And it didn't really much matter at the Targa, but he insisted to do it at the Targa as well. So the three co-drivers actually started the race. I was determined that I was going to have the fastest lap, because my friend Giunti had been killed in Argentina, and his mother, Countess Giunti in Sicily, or in Italy, had produced a magnificence about that big eagle on a marble base, one off, the Giunti trophy, for the fastest lap, which I now have at home. So I was determined I was going to get that, even though I didn't actually start the race. But then Gerard was driving, and at one point he got a puncture, and the spectators wouldn't come and help him. They did me, but not for him. And eventually he managed to get the wheel changed. And then after that, I guess, being a bit pissed off and all tense and everything, he went off the road through a gateway and found himself on the front lawn of a house up in the mountains where a wedding was taking place. So he was invited to join the wedding celebrations. Only in Sicily.
Yes.
But fortunately, that was on his second stint. So I'd done mine, and I'd won my Giunti trophy before that happened.
Do you think that your photographic memory helped you at the ring?
Absolutely.
If you could remember 45 miles, 14 miles ought to have been a piece of cake, right?
Absolutely. No, it's 14 miles. But it was also helped in another way. 1966, the very last event. You know, we talked about rallies earlier on, Liège-Rome-Liège, which was basically a road race. And then because of the tourist traffic, it just couldn't go on. And so the organisers decided that couldn't continue. When it was a rally, it was known as the Marathon de la Route, the road marathon, because it was 4 nights, 3 days, non-stop. And so the geniuses at the Automobile Club of Liège decided they would move the whole lot, lock, stock and barrel, to the Nürburgring. Not just the Nordschleifer, but the whole lot, the Schutzschleifer, right, and the Nordschleifer, which is actually about 20 miles around. Mm-hmm. And we were only allowed two drivers. So 84 hours, two drivers. And Jochen Nierpasch and I drove a Lotus Cortina. We decided early on we could go 2.5 hours on a fuel load. So we decided 2.5 hours was nowhere near enough for the guy off to get rest and food. 5 hours wasn't really enough. So we decided we would both do three stints, 7.5 hours non-stop at a time, which meant the guy who was off had plenty of time to eat, sleep, and so on. And we led for 72 hours, and then the car broke. So by the following year, I was with Porsche, and we went with a rather special car. It was a 911R, lightweight. Engine was fairly normal, but we had the only time I believe it was ever used, a Sportomatic gearbox. We got there, and this year the organizers allowed three drivers. And this damn thing used to start at like 10 o'clock at night, go out 4 nights, 3 days. And so we had three drivers, Nierpasch again, and Herman, and me. And we got there before the convoy down from Liège, and then getting ready to start. And the others said, well, Alfred, you're the rally driver, so you drive at night when it's foggy and raining, and we'll do the rest. So I drove four consecutive 7.5 hour nights around the Nürburgring.
Good God.
And after that, I knew every blade of grass by name. I mean,
so
1,000 kilometer races in daylight were nothing compared with that.
Wow. Your career moved to America and you spent time with Jim Hall. How did you get to know? I mean, how did the relationship start?
I knew Jim vaguely, but only very vaguely. We used to, in the 917s and Ferraris, mm-hmm, we used to do our 6 hour race on Saturday, mm-hmm, and then we'd all do the Can-Am race on Sunday, right, and make off with some of their money. And so I drove my 917 on Sunday. I think I finished fourth. And Jackie had driven the Chaparral. Mm-hmm. And I got back to the hotel at the end of the day, and this phone call, it was Jim Hall. And he said, Vic, I'm here at room, so and say, would you come up and have a word with me for a minute? So I went up and I said, I only knew him very vaguely. And he said, how would you like to drive the Chaparral for the rest of the year? I said, you've got to be joking. You've got Jackie Stewart driving it. No. He said, this was just a one-off thing with GM for publicity. We want a serious driver who really knows what he's doing with testing and that sort of thing. And we've looked at a lot of people. We think you're the guy we need. I said, thank you very much. And that was how it started. And one of the problems was nobody knew what was going to happen. Jim was great to work with. He was much more meticulous. That's not the word. He relied more on sort of being down to earth and solid, without perhaps the vivid imagination of Piëch. Mm. But on the other hand, imagination came into it too. You know how the 2J originated, or do you not?
Yeah.
They got a letter or a note from a 12-year-old schoolboy one day, and Jim still got it, with a diagram in it, saying, maybe you could put a sort of helicopter-type propeller up there, which pushes the car down to the ground. And Jim and the engineers and GM guys got together and, maybe we could. How do we do it? Yeah. And that was the origin
wow,
of that happening. And then Jim couldn't drive the Trans Am either, so I drove that. Normally it was a little bit down on power compared with the Fords and the Chrysler and the Javelins, but at Watkins Glen it rained.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm, rain was one of my specialities too.
Yeah.
So I was able to win in that there.
As you look back on your career, did you have a favorite event?
Oh, yeah. I mean, favorite, anything at Nürburgring.
Anything at the Nürburgring?
Oh, yeah. Targa Florio as well, of course. If I had to choose between the two, I'd say the Targa Florio, because it's not just the race, but it's also the whole atmosphere the island, the people, the food, you know, which after all is not that great in Germany, even now. So it has to be the Targa Florio, although as a race, anything at the Nürburgring. Non-favorite, although I won it, I would probably say Daytona. It's actually surprisingly quite tiring. You know, it's a lot less tiring now because they drive a couple of hours and they go off to bed for the night. But in those days, we used to, you know, with two of us to drive. And the when you go around turn one at Daytona, now there's a little sort of right left up to the first corner. That first corner was a lot further down in those days. And so the track itself was quite difficult. With those things, when you got down to that hairpin, the damn thing wouldn't go around the corner because it had to have a lot of downforce and a lot of understeer to cope with the banking. And Joseph and I both tried once dialing out some of the understeer, and then we immediately went back to it because we found we were getting sideways on the banking at 220 miles an hour. And then, it, you know, it's you're busy all the time at Daytona. There was no lighting then, only what we had on the car, which wasn't much. All the way to, down the back straight, no chicane. So you had to try and guess what the guy in front was going to be doing because we were going onto the banking at 220 miles an hour. So it was tiring. You were busy all the time.
Jim, that is an amazing interview, and I congratulate you for that. He was an amazing man, and you talk about him being an all-rounder, and I think there's more to him than that, because it wasn't just about being an all-rounder. He was good at everything he did. And in motorsport, you will get some people who go off and do different things in different genres, but they aren't necessarily very good at it. Quick Vic was good at everything that he turned his hand to. And do you ever think we'll see his type again?
I don't think so, Paul, partly because of the man that was Vic Elford, but also the times in our sport have changed so much. The idea of a Lewis Hamilton going off and doing a sports car race, or a Tom Christensen getting the opportunity to drive a Formula One car. Every now and then you'll see one of the rally guys cross over. Walter Röhrl did it. Sebastian Loeb tried to do it, that sort of stuff. You'll see a little bit at that level. But to be the overall all-arounder like Vic Elford was, no, one of a kind. And sadly, we've lost him. I want to close out, Paul, with this. I thought this was the perfect quote when I saw it from Andrew Frankel from Motorsport Magazine. He said, Vic Elford was the most versatile driver in the history of motorsport with an almost cartoonish bravery. And that summed him up in a sentence.
There's nothing more to say, really, Jim. Thank you for putting that tribute together. This has been a Historic Racing News radio show production, and as our special tribute to Vic Elford.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.